The headlines: Boris Johnson drops out of Britain's Conservative Party leadership contest, leaving Rishi Sunak set to become the next prime minister. Ukraine dismisses Russia's claims that Kiev is preparing to use a dirty bomb. And 9 people are killed and 47 others wounded in an attack by the Al-Shabaab terrorist group. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi and these are our top stories this hour. Former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has pulled out of the ruling party leadership contest, which would have left him return to power after having been ousted. Johnson claims that he had secured the backing of 102 lawmakers, but he has fallen short of reaching a unity with 2 contenders, Rishi Sunak and Penny Mordaunt. Sunak now looks set to become the next prime minister. He reportedly enjoys the backing of 150 lawmakers so far. Sunak had stepped down from Johnson's cabinet in July. That triggered a torrent of resignations and forced Johnson to quit. The British government has been dealing with political chaos since Liz Truss stepped down over her controversial tax slashing plans this week. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky dismisses as false allegations Russia's warning that Kiev is preparing to use a dirty bomb. Zelensky accused Moscow of fabricating stories about possible provocations by Kiev. Ukraine's foreign minister has also rejected Russia's claims that as absurd and dangerous. The two officials responded to Russia's defense minister, who had assisted on a separate phone call with his NATO counterparts, warned that the war in Ukraine is rapidly spiraling out of control. Sergei Shoigu told the French, British, and Turkish defense ministers that Ukraine could stage a provocation, which he called a dirty bomb. The UK Defense Secretary Ben Wallace, however, refused Moscow's claims that Western countries were facilitating a planned escalation of the war. From Donetsk, our correspondent Johnny Miller gives us more details.
One Ukrainian official said the attacks yesterday by Russia were as bad as the strikes on the 10th and 11th of October. That's when, of course, Russia started hitting this energy infrastructure. It's interesting that we're not really seeing any pictures of the damage of these strikes. The reason for that is that the Ukrainian government has demanded that its citizens don't post videos of Russian strikes. Of course, many of the videos we see are just of ordinary people getting out their phones and filming the damage. But we're not seeing that now, as there's an attempt by the Ukrainian government to stop any panic that arises from these strikes. There's also a bit of a propaganda war, as they say that their air defense is working. It's not clear how well it is working. Russia says that it's hitting its targets every day. And as you were saying, there's around 40% of Ukraine's energy infrastructure has already been destroyed. In terms of the battle at the front lines, the major focus right now is on Kherson. Ukraine has been building up forces north of Kherson. Russia is evacuating tens of thousands of civilians. They're doing this for 3 reasons. One, to stop pro-Russian civilians falling into Ukrainian hands. Secondly, to save civilian lives from Ukrainian strikes against the city of Kherson. And thirdly, to help Russia itself have a better operational maneuverability on the battlefield, to enable them to use heavy weapons themselves and set up defensive positions without killing civilians as well. And finally, where I am on the Donbass front, far to the north, east of Kherson, the front line is only about 5 kilometers from where I am now. Russia is trying to take advantage of Ukraine mobilizing in Kherson to make advances themselves in the Donbass, and they are making some slow, tentative advances near where I am now. Taking the rest of the Donbass and holding on to Kherson, very much the primary objectives of Russia right now.
French president says that Ukrainians will have to decide when peace is possible in the current war gripping their country. Speaking at a peace summit in the Italian capital, Rome, Emmanuel Macron said peace must not be held hostage to Russian power. Macron acknowledged that calling for peace could be hard to accept for those fighting for their homeland, but he stressed that it is necessary to have the courage to want peace. He also said that peace can be achieved at the negotiating table with Moscow. Macron has faced criticism over his repeated calls to negotiate with the Russian President Vladimir Putin. In his speech, Macron also praised Western backing for Kiev. Members and supporters of Morocco's main trade union have staged a demonstration in the capital, Rabat, to protest the high cost of living and the government's inaction to address the issue. The rally organized by the National Union of Labor in Morocco was held outside parliament. Protesters slammed the government for failing to curb rising prices. The demonstration came after several protests already held this week in Rabat and other cities across the nation. Inflation was well over 8% year on year in September due to surging food prices, which were up 14.7%. Fuel prices have also increased sharply, making Moroccans all the more furious. A terrorist attack on a hotel in Somalia's southern port city of Kismayo leaves 9 people dead and 47 others wounded. The attack happened on Sunday when a booby-trapped car rammed into the entrance of the hotel. All 4 attackers, including a suicide bomber, were killed by security forces. The Al-Shabaab terrorist group has claimed responsibility, saying that the target was the members of the federal government who were meeting at the hotel. The group has been waging a deadly insurgency against Somalia's fragile government for more than a decade. The Al-Qaeda-linked outfit often cries out attacks against the government. Civilian targets in the capital, Mogadishu, were also in danger, as well as regional towns. And Palestinians have held a funeral for a resistance fighter who was assassinated by the Israeli regime early this morning. Mourners condemned Tel Aviv for its crimes and called for justice. The victim, identified as Tamer Al-Kalini, was killed by a bomb explosion in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. He was a member of the Ayn al-Usud resistance group, which is now warning of a harsh response. Hamas has also said that the crime will not go unanswered, and the Islamic Jihad has reacted by saying that the assassination will only strengthen the Palestinians' resolve to fight on. Tensions have intensified in the occupied West Bank. On Saturday, Israeli soldiers shot a wound at a 16-year-old Palestinian in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in Al-Quds, claiming that he had injured an Israeli man in stabbing attack. The Palestinian activist Wafa al-Udaini joined us earlier from Gaza. She says Israel's assassination of resistance fighters only strengthens the Palestinians' will.
This policy by the occupation is not new. Like, they use to assassinate the leaders of resistance groups. But indeed, this policy will not work at all with Palestinians. The assassination they used since the occupation of Palestine in 1948, they used to assassinate the Palestinian leaders, especially the resistance groups. But for example, as you can see here in Gaza, they assassinated the resistance, Hamas and the Islamic Jihad groups. But indeed, what we can see here in the West, in the Gaza Strip, is that the resistance grows up, and now it becomes stronger and stronger than before. And for example, for Tamer Al-Kilani, he was a former prisoner. Indeed, they detained him for 8 years. And this thing actually doesn't ban him or hinder him from keeping resisting the occupation. Actually, after being released from the occupation, he continued to resist the occupation, to confront the occupation, and to defend his people and to defend his land.
A series of events have taken place recently involving Palestinian resistance groups, in particular Hamas and Fatah Party. First a reconciliation and then Hamas's rapprochement with Syria. This later development was a major scene as a breakthrough, so much so that it caught the attention of the U.S., which said the move would undermine the Palestinian cause and hurt Palestinians as a result. Washington's stance comes as a surprise, given how it has done nothing for Palestinians except backing a regime that violates their rights.
The Palestinian movement Hamas has restored relations with the Syrian government after holding a historic meeting with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The Syrian president also met with Palestinian factions. This is the first such visit by Hamas officials to the Syrian capital since the year 2012. Hamas said the movement will continue to build and develop solid relations with the Syrian Arab Republic, considering that this decision serves the nation and its just causes, with the cause of Palestine at its core. Yet the important question is, why the resumption of ties at this time? For starters, the resumption of relations between Hamas and Damascus would strengthen the axis of resistance in West Asia. Hamas will now cement its role within the axis of resistance against its enemy, Israel. This may impact the way each acts against the other, especially militarily. This reconciliation appears to have rattled the U.S. cage, which was quick to denounce the move. It said the Assad regime's outreach to this terrorist organization only reinforces its isolation. It also harms the interests of the Palestinian people. But Hamas's move formalizes a rapprochement that has been underway for some time and comes amid fundamental shifts in West Asia. For example, Turkey is considering a rapprochement with Assad. The UAE has already done the same. Also, Jordan's King Abdullah II has showed overtures. The United Arab Emirates and Bahrain have gone ahead and reopened their embassies in Damascus. This is while senior officials in several Arab states are pressing to reinstate Syria's membership of the Arab League.
In order to understand the resistance groups' movements, in particular Hamas, it has been a good idea to review what's occurred. Initially, there was reconciliation among Hamas, Fatah, and 12 other Palestinian factions, and then there was a meeting between Hamas and Lebanon's President Michel Aoun. Also, Hamas Political Bureau Chief Ismail Haniyeh visited Moscow recently and met with Russia's foreign minister. Finally, Hamas's reconciliation with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. All of these developments could hint at strengthening the resistance front.
Another important development has taken place that cannot go unnoticed. Palestinian factions signed a reconciliation agreement in Algeria, in which Hamas, Fatah, and 12 other Palestinian groups agreed to hold legislative and presidential elections within 1 year. In the Algiers meeting, Ismail Haniyeh said, "This is a historical moment through which we see Al-Quds." He thanked the Algerian president, Abdelmadjid Tebboune, for his country's efforts in sponsoring the talks. But what did he mean exactly? How would this reconciliation enable Palestinians to see Al-Quds? Yet the timing of these two events, the Algiers reconciliation of Palestinian factions, then Hamas's trip to Syria, gives the impression that there are serious diplomatic moves being made between Palestinian factions. Another development, which is another piece to this puzzle, is the head of Hamas's political bureau chief, Ismail Haniyeh, visiting Moscow recently and holding high-level political talks with Russian officials, including the foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. This puts the spotlight on Russia's role here. Russia is signaling how it wants to play a more constructive role when it comes to the West Asia region especially when it comes to Palestinians. This couldn't be any clearer than the stance that the PA President Mahmoud Abbas took when it came to Russia, which was relayed during the SICA meeting that was held recently. The Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, who met with the Russian President Vladimir Putin, relayed to him his mistrust of the U.S. in resolving the conflict with Israel, expressing an appreciation for Russia's role. He voiced his support for the Mideast quartet of international mediators, namely Russia, the U.S., the United Nations, and the European Union, but said the U.S. could not be left a free hand to act alone. He said, "We don't trust America, and you know our position. We don't trust it, we don't rely on it, and under no circumstances can we accept that America is the sole party in resolving a problem." Maybe that is why the U.S. is raising the alarm over the reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas. Now that they are on one page, they can act with one voice against Israel and the U.S. And the U.S. reaction to this is very telling when it says that it will take this out against Palestinians, instead of taking a diplomatic approach towards the two groups reconciling, since they can speak with one voice for the Palestinians. This may mean that there will be more pressure and violations by Israel against the Palestinians with full U.S. support.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Thank you. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
Leaders meeting with members of the Expediency Council. Two weeks ago, the chairman and members of the Expediency Council met with the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. In this program, we discussed the leader's speech and points of view expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. According to Article 112 of the Islamic Republic of Iran's constitution, the Expediency Council has a duty to clarify and decide what is the best course of action to take in cases where the Guardian Council has decided a bill passed by the Iranian parliament, the Majlis, contravenes either Iran's constitution or Islamic Sharia law. The Expediency Council also issues advice as and when needed. When called upon, by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The leader also appoints all permanent members and all rotational members of the council. After introducing and remarking about the newly appointed members of the council, Ayatollah Khamenei described the Expediency Council as a very significant and important institution, comprising of scholars, elites, experts, and highly experienced people capable of analyzing and providing excellent advice on all issues pertaining to the country, saying the fundamental duties of the Expediency Council are very important. Turning to recent events in Iran, the leader described the scattered and diffused riots as a passive and clumsy plot by the enemy against the progress and the great innovative movements of the Iranian nation. The leader emphasized, "As long as the nation remains faithful to the Islamic system and religious values, then these hostilities will continue, with the only solution being to resist." The leader also emphasized that all officials should be careful and vigilant, that they are not distracted from their primary responsibilities and duties in the domestic and foreign arenas by current events in the country. Ayatollah Khamenei thanked the members for their efforts in the last term of the Expediency Council, especially their efforts with regards to the general policies of the Seventh Plan, and went on to honor the memory of the deceased members of the Council, especially the late Ayatollah Hashemi Shahroudi. The leader said, "The Expediency Council has an esteemed position, both in terms of the presence of elites and experienced people in it, and because of its essential duties." Ayatollah Khamenei described the most critical responsibility of the Expediency Council as a task of determining what is expedient. He has stressed, "The issue of expediency is one of the high priority issues of the system, and according to the founder of the Islamic Republic, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, the Expediency Council's duties are so vital that neglecting them can often harm Islam." The leader emphasized it is necessary to know the issue and recognize the problem of expediency, and added, "In determining expediency, it should be done in an entirely reassuring way." Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei called the correct definition of general policies and up-to-date and guiding framework for laws and executive affairs in order to achieve goals. He added, "Some policies are permanent, but others are specific to a certain period and need to be updated." The leader considered the task of monitoring the good implementation of general policies as a delicate issue. He said, "Sometimes it is complained that this monitoring causes the work to be blocked. At the same time, legal considerations and rules should be taken into account so that monitoring, while preventing the deviation of legislative and executive work, does not cause a stop or delay in the affairs of the council." Effectiveness of general policies was the final point mentioned by the leader of the Islamic Revolution. Ayatollah Khamenei continued to refer to the recent cases and scattered and diffused riots and advised members of the Expediency Council as influential people in reforming affairs and neutralizing the plot of the enemy to pay enough attention to these issues and not to ignore them, emphasizing that in recent events, the role and involvement of the enemy is evident for all to see. He said, "Even impartial foreign experts admit that these issues are not as spontaneous." Emphasizing that in recent events, the role and involvement of the enemy is evident for all to see, he said, "Even impartial foreign observers have acknowledged and admitted that these events are not spontaneous internal matters. Of course, there may be issues where the public is dissatisfied, but the actions of the enemy, such as propaganda, trying to influence young minds, creating excitement, encouraging younger generation and young people to riot, teaching them ways to make explosive materials, are completely clear for all to see." Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, "The passivity and reactivity of the enemy's movement is that the Iranian nation made significant progress and advancement in a short period of time, and this was exactly what the enemies of this nation did not want. By plotting and spending money, they brought in people, including some politicians, in the United States, Europe, and other places." Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei emphasized, "These massive movements showed that the Iranian nation, besides being cheerful, religious, and adhering to spiritual values, the country also continues its movement forward, its advancement and progress." The leader considered the presence of millions of young people in the Arba'een procession and religious movement as an example of piety, religious belief, and the great movement of the Iranian nation. He added, "In fact, the initiative was in the hands of the Iranian nation, and the enemy was forced to react clumsily and stupidly, and they planned this disturbance and rioting." The leader of the Islamic Revolution emphasized that the different ruling for those who came to the streets and noted, "Some of these people were either the enemy's agents, or if they were not enemy's agents, they were in the same direction as the enemy. Some are emotional individuals. In the case of the second category, cultural work needs to be done. But regarding the first category, the judiciary and security officials should do their duties." Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, "Some people say the atmosphere should not turn into a security atmosphere, and I generally agree with this point of view as much as possible. But nonetheless, I would say that the judiciary and security forces need to perform their duties." He emphasized, "As long as the Iranian nation holds the flag of Islam high and is with the Islamic system, these hostilities from evil hegemonic powers will continue, and the only way and the only solution is to resist." However, he said, "It is incorrect to say that moving on the path of Islam has created trouble for us, because these evil hegemonic powers are opposed to the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic, and this is clear for all to see."
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and here is another thought-provoking saying from Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, from his cousin and father-in-law, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. "Oh Ali, three characters are high moral standards: regard for the one who ruptured relations with you, granting the one who deprived you, and pardoning the one who wronged you."
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. an introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the role models of faithfulness. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the role models of the faithfulness in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that when we talk about the lifestyle, we must have someone to follow. There must be a role model in the history, in the Islamic history. There must be some people, or the leaders, or the leading personalities must become the role model so that when we see them, we can follow them. And if we cannot follow them, if they cannot become the role model, then obviously we cannot apply the Islamic lifestyle in our daily life or in our life. Therefore, when we look at the Islamic teachings, we see that, for example, in the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when he talks about one of the role models in chapter 19, verse 54, he says, وَذْكُرْ فِي الْكِتَابِ إِسْمَعِيلَ إِنَّهُ كَانَ صَادِقَ الْوَعْدِ. He says that, remember in the book, the prophet Ismail, that he was one of the truthful ones who used to fulfill his promise, his covenant with the others. Now, when we refer to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam about this verse, he said that one day, Hazrat Ismail, the prophet Ismail, he made a promise to see someone at a specific place, out of city. So he went there and he was waiting for the person, but the other person forgot to come to the place and see Hazrat Ismail, the prophet Ismail. And therefore he waited there until the companions of the prophet Ismail, they got worried that why the prophet is not coming back. Therefore one person went there and he asked him that, why you're not coming? We are worried about your absence. He said, I made a promise to that person to see him here, but he hasn't come yet. Therefore, his companions went after the person. They found him and they brought him to the prophet. And he said, oh, prophet, I apologize because I forgot that I have a commitment to see you at this place. And the prophet Ismail said, even if you were not coming, I was waiting until you come. And since you came, now I can leave. So this is what the prophet's personalities teaches us. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the role models of the faithfulness in the Islamic lifestyle, and we gave the example of Prophet Ismail. Similarly, when we look at the life of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, we see that even a day, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he has made a promise to see someone at a specific place. And that place, when the sun rays, obviously there was a hot weather and it was too hot. So companions of the Prophet has said to him to go to the shadow. And he refused. He said, because since I have made the promise to see him at this place, I will wait until he comes. So these things shows us that how the prophets, when they used to make a promise to someone, how they used to be faithful to that. And obviously, when they are at the position of a teacher, they're basically teaching us, they're telling us that no matter when you made a promise, whether it's a hot weather, whether it's a cold weather, whatever it is, you must fulfill the promise, because the important thing is to fulfilling the promise. The important thing is to fulfill the covenant and be faithful to what you have said, so that your tongue, your speech has a value amongst the people. Therefore, it is necessary to be faithful. On the other hand, we have the example of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, the fourth Imam, where he took some loan from someone, and as a security, he gave him a piece of thread. So when the time came when he wanted to give back the money, he went to the person and he asked him to give back the thread, a piece of thread. He said that it was nothing, it had no value, so I lost it. But Imam said, until you don't bring it, I will not give you back the money. So when he found it, he brought it, Imam said that, look, this piece of threat is of no value. But when it has become a security, and we promise that you will give me back this piece of thread and I will give you the money back, then obviously it has a value. Why? Because it is the part of the covenant that we have made, the promise that we have made. Therefore, it is necessary to be faithful to the promise and covenant that we make, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
A free climber known as the French Spider-Man scales a 48-story skyscraper in Paris to fulfill a goal he set for himself once he reached the age of 60.
A few years back, I promised myself that the day I turn 60, I have to climb the total tower. Because 60 years old marks retirement age in France, and so I thought this would make a very good knot.
Alain Roberts says this building is not as hard as others he has climbed. The French Spider-Man has ascended over 100 of the world's tallest buildings, including the Sydney Tower, the Sears Tower in Chicago, and the Burj Khalifa in Dubai, amongst many others. Roberts says he spent 2 decades climbing mountains before attempting urban climbs. Using his rock climbing experience, he sometimes carries a small bag of climbing chalk to help him grasp the small protrusions of building walls. Many of his climbs can last several hours. The 60-year-old daredevil says he wants to give people the message that age is a number and one can still be active and do sports.
A celebrated Chinese artist integrates his life experiences and the beauty of his homeland using his own distinctive style of traditional painting. Chen Jialing is known for his Chinese ink paintings. Chen brings to life the imaginative richness and culture through his depictions of landscape with every brush of color. He is most famous for breaking traditional painting techniques while staying within the framework of the art form. Chen says one of his favorite subjects is the Jianggong Mountains, especially during certain hours when the sunlight offers its own visual delights.
The composition of this painting is based on the main peak of the Jianggong Mountains, because the main peak is the most majestic and imposing, especially at noon. The sun shines on the trees, forming a contour light involving trees and the large mountains, which is extremely beautiful.
The 85-year-old artist has also used fused traditional landscape painting with modern technology. Though Chen has participated in numerous art exhibitions, but he says his first solo exhibit was held in his 70s, and that's when his career really took off. Chen says he plans to paint as much of his homeland's stunning scenery as possible during his lifetime. If you have a sweet tooth, then this next bit of news is just for you. Visitors are now taking advantage of the expanded version of Cakeland, which is an immersive art gallery in the U.S. city of Los Angeles. The structure is meant to feel like a giant multi-layered cake. It's entirely made of artificial materials, but looks like if it's full of cherries, whipped cream, and layers of cake. Artist Scott Hoff says he used nearly a ton of pipe frosting, 120 mirrors, and thousands of cherries. Plus, he embedded thousands of crystals in the walls as a final touch. The artist says he chose to develop Cakeland after he noticed how much his artificial cake sculptures were welcomed by viewers.
So I chose cake because, number one, it's really beautiful. Number two, it's really fun to do. And number three, it engages the viewers in such a meaningful way.
Hoff says he never actually made a real cake before and has mainly followed his enthusiasm for fake food as the inspiration for this project. Visitors are able to walk through the cake, a labyrinth, and explore various rooms. While there is a lot of deliciousness and lightness of the cakes, visitors to this cake land can discover some interesting darker elements as they wander around. The art installation has continued to expand since it was founded by Hov in 2020. Robots are slowly but surely becoming part of everyday life, taking on human roles in different areas. Now, fast food restaurants can make French fries faster and better as a robot called Flippy 2 takes over the job.
When an order comes in through the restaurant system, it automatically spits out the instructions to Flippy. Takes a frozen product, fries it for the precise amount of time, and puts a finished product in the end. It does it faster, more accurately, more reliably, and happier than most humans do it.
Flippy 2 has been created in a robotic lab in California called MISO after 5 years of efforts by its developers. According to the project engineers, a really good understanding of the food science is needed to make sure the food quality is there, how different food sticks together, and how the temperature and heat affect it. The MISO CEO says the machine can cook several meals with different recipes simultaneously, removing the need for catering staff.
This technology utilizes a whole bunch of computer vision. There's cameras throughout the system, including right here we have these food identification cameras. The cameras not only guide the robot and tell it exactly where it is in space and how to move through this area, but also identifies the food type and it knows the recipe for each one.
The MISO CEO says tasks like the fry station are the kind that humans are most happy to afloat. The name Flippy comes from the original machine designed to flip burgers, which was not very useful for restaurants.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Freedom is an essential virtue that is valued not only by humans but animals as well, just like two eagle owls that have been released into the wild after being born in a Madrid zoo. The two owl twins were freed after months of training to survive in the nature. First, they were taken to a big aviary to develop the necessary skills, including those for hunting prey. The aviary is designed to have a similar environment to the local mountain range. Meantime, they need to gain muscle and come to a suitable weight. After passing various skill tests, the owls are released as part of Madrid Zoo's breeding program of night birds of prey. 7 eagle owls and 11 barn owls have been released since the program was launched in 2017. However, some of them flew back seeking shelter as they failed to adapt to the nature.
restoration requires intensive research and training and loads of skill. But imagine the anxiety while professionals embark on restoring rare paintings. Under careful supervision, French restorers are working to give back to 500-year-old paintings their former glory. They were rescued from a fire that engulfed the Notre-Dame Cathedral in Paris in 2019. These works date back from the 17th and early 18th century. The paintings, including 22 with large format, were temporarily stored in a warehouse and now being restored at an undisclosed location. The fire caused strictly no damage to the paintings, but they have accumulated thick layers of dirt and smoke on the surface after hanging in the cathedral for centuries. Some of the works also have paint loss due to overcleaning that restorers say need to be repaired elegantly.
On the outskirts of China's metropolis, Shanghai, a tiny island has been dubbed Cat Island as it provides shelter for stray animals. Since it opened last month, a charity based on the island is taking in cats mainly brought from Shanghai residents. These small carnivorous mammals are neutered and evaluated, and those with good temper and health are allowed to roam free on the island. The city's Stray Cats Management Center says their trap-neuter-release policy is to protect stray cats, limits their population, and maintain ecological balance. However, Shanghai has an estimated 200 stray cats per square kilometer, which means other methods will be needed to control the urban population, stray cats. A pair of baby panda twins make their debut appearance at the Chongqing Zoo in southwest China, with visitors flocking to cherish the abundance of cuteness.
Our returnee panda, Ershan, gave birth to the twin brother and sister on July 22nd this year. Currently, the elder brother weighs 4.3 grams and the younger sister weighs 0.6 grams. They're in good condition at present.
The twins' first public appearance was on Saturday, the first day of the week-long National Day holidays. During this week, the pair of giant panda cubs will be on display in the nursery of the panda house of the zoo. Their mother, Ershan, once lived in Canada as a goodwill envoy, but returned to her homeland in 2020. This was Ershan's second delivery of twins. A total of 21 pandas currently live in the Chongqing Zoo, which has been breeding giant pandas since the 1960s. The evolution of robots has been one of the fascinations of recent technological developments. And now the most cutting-edge achievements in that department were presented to the public during a conference in Beijing. The four-day annual World Robot Conference was held both offline and online. It featured three major events, including forum, expo, and competition. On display were more than 500 sets of robots from 130 companies from China and abroad. The conference gave an idea of how the future of humanity will be impacted by the automations. It shows how they can contribute to different sectors, from the restaurant industry and medicine to elderly care, agriculture, and manufacturing. An aircraft powered by electricity may still be some way off, but one of its types is already here thanks to a whole range of innovative solutions being developed by aviation firms. American company Aviation Aircraft has debuted its all-electric plane in Washington State. the aircraft named Alice took off the runway at Grand County International Airport and flew for 8 minutes. It reached an altitude of 3,500 feet before touching down the ground. According to the company, the aircraft produces no carbon emissions, significantly reduces noise, and costs a fraction to operate compared to usual light jets. The company says it continues to develop and tweak the plane's battery system for an hour flight.
We're targeting a design criteria of 35 minutes for a charge. And so that'll be a charge for the typical route length. It's actually, as I just said, it's actually a design point. So going back to the comment I made earlier about designing batteries for aircraft, it's one of the considerations is how quickly do we want it to charge? How much power do you want to be able to draw from it? So again, we're targeting, call it 30 minutes of charge for an hour of flight time or about 2C if you're...
The company aims to find its way into the market for trips that sit between 150 and 250 miles, a range that features aircraft similar in size to Alice. It will also be for both commuter and cargo flights. For aircraft manufacturers, this paradigm shift is driving fuel savings in flight and on the ground, reducing carbon footprints and NOx emissions while also improving reliability and cutting maintenance cost.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Three months after quitting over Partygate and other scandals, the former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is reportedly building support for a comeback. Liz Truss quit on Thursday, 20th of October, after a chaotic 6 weeks in office. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Germany's national broadcaster Deutsche Welle has more on this story. Boris Johnson and former finance minister Rishi Sunak led the potential contenders on Friday to replace British Prime Minister Liz Truss, who resigned a day earlier after a turbulent 45 days in office. Boris Johnson, who is reportedly flying back from the Caribbean, has not confirmed whether he will run, but his allies are working to gather support. If he succeeds, it would be quite the comeback for a politician who is both popular and polarizing. Johnson was forced to step down last July over a number of ethical and financial scandals, including holding official government parties during COVID-19 lockdowns. I think he's got that proven track record to turn things around, Conservative lawmaker Paul Bristow said of Boris Johnson on LBC Radio, adding that he was the character the Labour Party fears as he can win the next general election. Labour is currently in opposition. The Conservatives are now polling at their lowest in British history, thanks to months of scandals that culminated in Liz Truss's unfunded plan to cut taxes, which caused a run on the British pound and damaged Britain's pension funds. She was then forced to execute a series of embarrassing U-turns. Huge scepticism remains over Boris Johnson's standing within the Conservative Party. One of Boris Johnson's former advisers, who asked not to be identified, told the Reuters news agency that he was unlikely to reach the target, having alienated dozens of Conservatives during his scandal-ridden tenure. Other Conservative lawmakers threatened to quit the party if he returns as their leader. The other favourites in the race for the leadership of the Conservative Party are former Chancellor Rishi Sunak and House of Commons leader Penny Mordaunt. Rishi Sunak, who came second to Liz Truss in a summertime leadership contest, is favoured by some as a safe pair of hands who can steady the struggling economy. He was proven right in his warnings that Liz Truss's fiscal plan threatened the economy, but he remains deeply unpopular with some Conservatives after he helped to trigger the summer rebellion against Boris Johnson. Penny Mordaunt, who came third in the contest that Liz Truss won, is seen as a fresh pair of hands largely untainted by earlier administrations. Mordaunt is the former defence minister under another Tory Prime Minister, Theresa May, and is popular with the party grassroots. Candidates who want to replace Liz Truss need to get the support of 100 members of parliament from the ruling Conservatives to enter the race, to lead the party and become prime minister. The party has set a one-week deadline to choose its new leader, having spent the entire summer narrowing down candidates to succeed Boris Johnson in an earlier vote. This time round, nominations will close on Monday, and only three candidates can win enough support out of the 357 Conservative lawmakers. Political website Guido Forks, which is running a tally of declared support, had Boris Johnson at 52, Rishi Sunak at 55, and Penny Mordaunt at 19 by midday on Friday. One of these candidates will then be knocked out by a vote by lawmakers who will hold an indicative vote on the final two. The party's 172,000 members will then get to decide between the two finalists in an online vote, with winner announced by 28th of October. The new leader would be the fifth British Prime Minister in the past 6 years. Whoever takes over the party has a mountain to climb to try to restore or renew the reputation of the Conservative Party, which holds a big majority in Parliament and need not call an election for another 2 years. Research from People Polling suggests that 53% of the British public would vote for the opposition Labour Party if there was a general election tomorrow, and just 14% would vote for the Conservatives. The British newspaper The Guardian has more on this story. Boris Johnson is gaining ground in his audacious bid to return to No. 10 Downing Street, despite critics warning he risks plunging the Conservatives into fresh chaos over the impending parliamentary inquiry into the Partygate scandal. As the former Prime Minister raced back from his Caribbean holiday to drum up support among MPs, Rishi Sunak remained ahead and a favourite to win, with close to 90 publicly declared backers, including Dominic Raab and Sajid Javid, and with his supporters claiming he had passed the threshold of 100 names required to get on the ballot paper. However, Boris Johnson won the support of six current cabinet ministers, that is Ben Wallace, Simon Clarke, Chris Heaton-Harris, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Alex Sharma and Anne-Marie Trevelyan, with the former Home Secretary Priti Patel is believed to be considering coming out in his favour.